Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is exactly 1 year and a day since the election of Donald Trump as president. It has been a mind-boggling year of savage political and cultural retrogression. A particularly odious revengement has been the murderous controversy over racially segregationist war monuments, a truly black and white dispute. Today's program is about a newer war monument that displays the names of dead soldiers of a disputed war, which has itself been fiercely controversial. It might be noted that the USA is being saturated with non-war lists of names of dead Americans, women, men, and children who are multiply mass murdered with guns and cars by other Americans. Saturday is Armistice Day 99. In the United States, it is known as Veterans Day, which purports to honor veterans, but in actual truth, worships war itself rather than armistice, which essentially is defined as a temporary end to a war. This Armistice Day, it has been 35 years since the Vietnam War Memorial was dedicated in Washington, D.C. in 1982, 7 years after the war ended. A deceptively simple design that contains the names of nearly 60,000 Americans killed in Vietnam, it is only a fraction of the deaths from that war, and only Americans. The Vietnam Memorial will not be complete until the names of everybody on all sides of the war, as well as civilians killed, are listed. A separate wall might be set alongside with the names of all Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers who were killed in the war, both walls enclosed by an immense memorial listing the names of the millions of Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians who were not combatants, but were by far the largest number of those the war annihilated. Thousands of Vietnam veterans crowded into Washington, D.C. from all over the USA for the dedication of the Vietnam Wall, hoping to be finally recognized after years of neglect and disparagement. After bearing the nation's guilt and sense of dishonor for the war, they wanted America to acknowledge them for what they had endured in its name. Shea Williams, one of five of us, vets and friends, who traveled from Oregon to D.C. for the dedication, said of the veterans' reunions, they were soul food for one another. I begin today's program with Maya Lin, who designed the Vietnam Wall, and explains why and how. She wrote a book, Boundaries, from which the following has been excerpted. Making the Memorial for the Dead of the Vietnam War by Maya Lin. I think the most important aspect of the design of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial was that I had originally designed it for a class I was taking at Yale and not for the competition. In that sense, I had designed it for me, or more exactly, for what I believed it should be. I never tried to second-guess a jury, and it wasn't until after I had completed the design that I decided to enter it into the competition. The design emerged from an architectural seminar I was taking during my senior year. The initial idea of a memorial had come from a notice posted at the school announcing a competition for a Vietnam Veterans Memorial. The class, which was on funereal architecture, had spent the semester studying how people, through the built form, expressed their attitudes toward death. As a class, we thought the memorial was an appropriate design for our program, so we adopted it as our final design project. At that point, not much was known about the actual competition, so for the first half of the assignment, we were left without concrete directions for what they were looking for, or even who they were. Instead, we had to determine for ourselves what a Vietnam memorial should be. Since a previous project had been to design a memorial for World War III, I had already begun to ask the simple questions. What exactly is a memorial? What should it do? My design for a World War III memorial was a tomb-like underground structure that I deliberately made to be a very futile and frustrating experience. I remember the professor of the class coming up to me afterward, saying quite angrily, "If I had a brother who died in that war, I would never want to visit this memorial." I was somewhat puzzled that he didn't quite understand that World War III would be of such devastation that none of us would be around to visit any memorial, and that my design was instead a pre-war commentary. In asking myself what a memorial to a Third World War would be, I came up with a political statement that was meant as a deterrent. I had studied earlier monuments and memorials while designing that memorial, and I continued this research with the design of the Vietnam Memorial. As I did more research on monuments, I realized most carried larger, more general messages about a leader's victory or accomplishments rather than the lives lost. In fact, at the national level, individual lives were very seldom dealt with until you arrive at the memorials for World War I. Many of these memorials included the names of those killed. Partly it was a practical need to list those whose bodies could not be identified, since dog tags as identification had not yet been adopted, and owing to the nature of the warfare, many were not identifiable. But I think as well the listing of names reflected a response by these designers to the horrors of World War I, to the immense loss of life. The images of these monuments were extremely moving. They captured emotionally what I felt memorials should be, honest about the reality of war, about the loss of life in war, and about remembering those who served and especially those who died. I made a conscious decision not to do any specific research on the Vietnam War and the political turmoil surrounding it. I felt that the politics had eclipsed the veterans, their service, and their lives. I wanted to create a memorial that everyone would be able to respond to, regardless of whether one thought our country should or should not have participated in the war. The power of a name was very much with me at the time, partially because of the memorial rotunda at Yale. In Wolseley Hall, the walls are inscribed with the names of all the Yale alumni who have been killed in wars. I had never been able to resist touching the names cut into these marble walls, and no matter how busy or crowded the place is, a sense of quiet, a reverence always surrounds those names. Throughout my freshman and sophomore years, the stonecutters were carving in by hand the names of those killed in the Vietnam War, and I think it left a lasting impression on me, the sense of the power of a name. One memorial I came across also made a strong impression on me. It was a monument of the missing soldiers of the World War I Battle of the Somme by Sir Edwin Nutyens in Thiepval, France. The monument includes more than 100,000 names of people who were listed as missing because, without ID tags, it was impossible to identify the dead. The cemetery contains the bodies of 70,000 dead. To walk past those names and realize those lost lives, the effect of that is the strength of the design. This memorial acknowledged those lives without focusing on the war or on creating a political statement of victory or loss. This apolitical approach became the essential aim of my design. I did not want to civilize war by glorifying it or by forgetting the sacrifices involved. The price of human life in war should always be clearly remembered. But on a personal level, I wanted to focus on the nature of accepting and coming to terms with a loved one's death. Simple as it may seem, I remember feeling that accepting a person's death is the first step to overcome that loss. What then would bring back the memory of a person? A specific object or image would be limiting. A realistic sculpture would only be the interpretation of that time. I wanted something that all people could relate to on a personal level. At this time, I had as yet no form, no specific artistic image. The use of the names was a way to bring back everything someone could remember about a person. The strength in a name is something that has always made me wonder at the abstraction, and that's in quotes, of the design. The ability of a name to bring back every single memory you have of that person is far more realistic and specific and much more comprehensive than a still photograph, which captures a specific moment in time or a single event or a generalized image that may or may not be moving for all who have connections to that time. Then someone in the class received the design program, which stated the basic philosophy of the Vietnam Memorial's design and also its requirements. All the names of those missing and killed, 57,000, must be part of the memorial. The design must be apolitical, harmonious with the site, and conciliatory. I always wanted the names to be chronological, to make it so that those who served in return from the war could find their place in the memorial. I initially had the names beginning on the left side and ending on the right. In a preliminary critique, a professor asked what importance that left for the apex, and I, too, thought it was a weak point, so I changed the design for the final critique. Now, the chronological sequence began and ended at the apex, so that the timeline would circle back to itself and close the sequence. A progression in time is memorialized. The design is not just a list of the dead. To find one name, chances are you will see the others close by, and you will see yourself reflected through them. The memorial was designed before I decided to enter the competition. I didn't even consider that it might win. When I submitted the project, I had the greatest difficulty trying to describe it in just one page. It took longer, in fact, to write the statement that I felt was needed to accompany the required drawings than to design the memorial. The description was critical to understanding the design, since the memorial worked more on an emotional level than a formal level. Many of the issues I dealt with were connected with the text of the memorial and my decision to list the names chronologically. People felt it would be an inconvenience to search out a name in a book, then find its panel location, and thought that an alphabetical listing would be more convenient, until a tally of how many Smiths had died made it clear that alphabetical listing would not be feasible. The MIA groups, the Missing in Action groups, wanted their list of the missing separated out and listed alphabetically. I knew this would break the strength of the timeline, interrupting the real-time experience of the piece, so I fought hard to maintain the chronological listing. I ended up convincing the groups that the time in which an individual was noted as missing was the emotionally compelling time for family members. A system of noting these names with a symbol that could be modified if the veteran was later found alive or officially declared dead would appease the concerns of the MIA groups, without breaking the timeline. I knew the timeline was key to the experience of the memorial. A returning veteran would be able to find his or her time of service when finding a friend's name. The text of the memorial and the fact that I had left out everything except the names led to a fight about what else needed to be said about the war. The apex is the memorial's strongest point. I argued against the addition of text at that point for fear that a politically charged statement, one that would force us specific reading, would destroy the apolitical nature of the design. Throughout this time, I was very careful not to discuss my political beliefs. I played it extremely naive about politics, instead turning the issue into a purely aesthetic one. Text could be added, but whatever was said needed to fit in three lines to match the height of the dates 1959 and 1975, that it would be adjacent to. The veterans approved this graphic parameter, and the statements became a simple prologue and epilogue. The only other issue was the polished black granite and how it should be detailed, over which I remember having a few arguments with the architects of record. The architects could not understand my choice of a reflective, highly polished black granite. One of them felt I was making a mistake and the polished surface would be too feminine, quote unquote. Also puzzling to them was my choice of detailing the monument as a thin veneer with barely any thickness at its top edges. They wanted to make the monument's walls read as a massive, thick stone wall, which was not my intention at all. I always saw the wall as pure surface and interface between light and dark, where I cut the earth and polished its open edge. The wall dematerializes as a form and allows the names to become the object, a pure and reflective surface that would allow visitors the chance to see themselves with the names. I do not think I thought black as a color, more as the idea of a dark mirror into a shadowed, mirrored image of the space, a space we cannot enter and from which the name separates us, an interface between the world of the living and the world of the dead. As far as all of the controversy is concerned, I really never wanted to go into it too much. The memorial starkness, its being below grade, being black, and how much my age, gender, and race played a part in the controversy, we'll never quite know. I think it is actually a miracle that the piece ever got built. From the very beginning, I often wondered if it had not been an anonymous entry, number 1026, but rather an entry by Maya Lin, would I have been selected? I remember at the very first press conference, a reporter asking me if I did not find it ironic that the memorial was for the Vietnam War and that I was of Asian descent. I was righteous in my response that my race was completely irrelevant. It took me almost 9 months to ask the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, in charge of building the memorial, if my race was at all an issue. It never occurred to me that it would be, and I think they had taken all the measures they could to shield me from such comments about a gook designing the memorial. I remember reading the article that appeared in the Washington Post referring to an Asian memorial for an Asian war, and I knew we were in trouble. The controversy exploded in Washington after that article. Ironically, one side attacked the design for being too Asian, while others saw simplicity and understatement, not as an intention to create a more Eastern meditative state, but as a minimalist statement which they interpreted as being non-referential and disconnected from human experience. This left the opinion in many that the piece emanated from a series of intellectualized aesthetic decisions, which automatically pitted artists against veterans. The fact that I was from an Ivy League college and had hair down to my knees further fueled this distrust of the design and suspicions of a hippie college liberal or aesthetic elitist forcing her art and community upon them. Perhaps it was an empathetic response to the idea about war that had led me to cut open the earth, an initial violence that heals in time but leaves a memory like a scar. But this imagery, which some detractors would later describe as a black gash of shame and sorrow, in which the color black was called the universal color of shame and dishonor, would prove incredibly difficult to defend. The very fact that the veterans themselves had required the listing, and therefore the acknowledgement of the more than 57,000 casualties, which is a landmark in our country in terms of seeing a war through the individual lives lost, was very hard for many to face. I remember Ross Perot, when he was trying to persuade the veterans that it was an inappropriate design, asking me if I truly didn't feel that the veterans would prefer a parade instead, something happy or uplifting. And I can remember thinking that a parade would not, in the long term, help them to overcome the enormous trauma of the politics of that war. I do not think I fully realized until the dedication and homecoming parade that the veterans needed both. In effect, the veterans gave themselves their own homecoming. In November 1982, I was in tears watching these men welcoming themselves home after almost 10 years of not being acknowledged by their country for their service, their sacrifice. But until the memorial was built, I don't think I realized that the design was experiential and cathartic, and most importantly, designed not for me, but for them. And initially, the veterans did not see the chronology of the names allowed a returning veteran the ability to find his or her own time frame on the wall and created a psychological space for them that directly focused on human response and feeling. There was always the expectation that since the war had been controversial, the memorial must be also. It wasn't so much an artistic dispute as a political one. The choice to make an apolitical memorial was itself political to those who felt only a positive statement about the war would make up for the earlier anti-war days, a past swing to the left now to be balanced. It was extremely naive of me to think that I could produce a neutral statement that would not become politically controversial simply because it chose not to take sides. Anyway, the push, as one congressman put it, to politicize the design didn't really affect the memorial in this way. The addition of a statue of the infantrymen and then the addition of the female statue to make them equal are to me sad indicators that some politicians believe you can please all of the people all of the time by compromise and conglomerate works. These statues leave only the false reading that the wall is for the dead and they are for the living, when the design I made was for the returning veterans and equally names all who served regardless of race, creed, or sex. I am only glad that the three infantrymen are not where they had been originally intended to be, right in the center of the memorial, heads sticking up higher than the wall, converting the walls to a backdrop and violating that private contemplative space. Ironically, the compromise memorializes the conflict in the building of the peace. People cannot resolve that war, nor can they separate the issues, the politics, from it. As for me, the first time I visited the memorial after it was completed, I found myself searching out the name of a friend's father and touching it. It was strange to realize that I was another visitor, and I was reacting to it as I had designed it. And that was by Maya Lin, Making the Memorial. And this article has been excerpted from the New York Review of Books. Maya Lin is an artist, architect, and lives in New York City. She has written a book, Boundaries, from which this essay has been taken. She was later commissioned to design four sculptures along the Columbia River to commemorate the Lewis and Clark bicentennial. One of these sculptures is in Pacific County, Washington. And now, I would like to read something I wrote. Opening the Book of the Dead. The names of the American dead occupy the black granite wall of the Vietnam War Memorial, chronologically by the days of their deaths, arranged in daily sequence in alphabetical order. I was at the wall when it was dedicated on Armistice Day weekend, renamed Veterans Day in the USA, in 1982, looking for names of a few dead Marines I last saw wrapped in ponchos and tossed aboard outgoing helicopters. I purchased a large book the size of a phone directory of a small city. It contained the names of the 55,000 or 57,000 dead engraved on the wall and where each was located. I left Washington, D.C. with my friends from Oregon. We drove through Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nebraska, Utah, Idaho, and Oregon, reaching home in Cannon Beach 5 days later. We stopped every night at motels or the homes of friends or relatives, and each day we made several stops for food, gas, bathrooms, and just to get out and stretch. On the back window of our small truck was a Vietnam Veterans of America sticker, the group that built and dedicated the wall. Everywhere we stopped, people noticed the sticker, and almost everyone was related to or had known men who were killed in Vietnam. Everywhere we stopped, I opened the Book of the American Dead and found the names people wished to see. Many of them ran their fingers across the written names, as had most of us, the carved names of our friends on the wall. In this manner, I crossed the continent. By the time we reached the Pacific coast, the American Book of the Dead was as well thumbed as a phone book in a public booth, if anyone remembers public phone booths. Until then, I had not really understood the personal impact of Vietnam on America's heart. Each time I opened the book, I felt I was performing a ritual of immense, unrecognized grief. I end today's program with a poem by the great World War I poet Siegfried Sassoon, who, despite his Teutonic name, was a British infantry officer. He wrote about a war memorial with names of the dead that most likely was a predecessor monument that impressed Maya Lin. On passing the new Menin Gate. Who will remember, passing through this gate, the unheroic dead who fed the guns? Who shall absolve the foulness of their fate, those doomed, conscripted, unvictorious ones? Crudely renewed, the salient holds its own. Paid are its dim defenders by this pomp, paid with a pile of peace-complacent stone, the armies who endured that sullen swamp. Here was the world's worst wound, and here with pride their name liveth forever, the Gateway claims. Was ever an immolation so belied as these intolerably nameless names? Well might the dead who struggled in the slime rise and deride this sepulcher of crime. And that was by Siegfried Sassoon on Passing the New Menin Gate. This is Michael McCusker. This past Tuesday was the centennial of the Russian Revolution. And Tuesday was the first significant defeat of Trumpism in notable statewide elections. Among them was the defiant upset of a boastful, self-described homophobe by a transgender woman in Virginia, Danica Rome, who was the first openly transgender person elected to a state legislature. She dedicated her win, quote, to every person who has ever been singled out, who has ever been stigmatized, who has ever been the misfit, who has ever been the kid in the corner, who has ever needed someone to stand up for them when they didn't have a voice of their own. This one is for you. Her message is certainly pertinent to tonight's 79th anniversary of Kristallnacht in 1938. Happy Armistice Day.